Well, good morning, all. Genesis 37 this morning, starting the story of Joseph. So if you could, turn to Genesis chapter 37 there. So I've shared before that when I was in college, I stretched 4 years into five, in part because I got to the end of my junior year. My major was computer science. I got burned out, decided I didn't want to do computer science anymore. And so I decided to change my major at the very end of my junior year. I was one or two classes short of finishing my major, and I thought, I'm done with computer science, which is strange considering it's what I do for a living now. But so I had to go an extra year. And I had been living off campus for 2 years. But I thought, you know, I'd kind of like to maybe be a resident assistant. And it was a bit unusual for somebody to be off campus for that long and to go back and be a resident assistant. So I knew it was going to be kind of a challenge or a big jump. But I went ahead and I applied and met with the, I don't even know what you call them, it's the husband and a wife. Every dorm had a husband and a wife that would then oversee the dorm, and then you would have resident assistants, one on each floor or two on every floor. And so I met with him, and they asked me a lot of questions. They knew I was a Christian. And they said, how are you going to do here? You know, you realize this is not a Christian environment and all that. And I'm like, I think I can handle it. They asked me a lot of questions that they didn't ask others. And then they brought in all the other RAs that were already on staff, and they all questioned me, you know, about my faith. And one of the questions they asked was, if you happen to see somebody on the floor who's homosexual, how are you going to respond to that? Which, at that time, that wasn't really, it wasn't what it is today at all. So I just answered honestly, you know. But anyway, they went ahead and they hired me. So I was all set. I was like, this is great, you know. So I was brought on staff as a resident assistant. And, you know, I'll be real frank, and this may sound a little bit prideful, but I was well-liked by most of the guys on the floor. I got along with everybody. I didn't hide the fact that I was a Christian, but I was fair and I was equitable. And like I said, I got along with most of the guys on the floor, most of the unsaved guys. Steve Schmeckel, I actually asked Steve if he wanted to come back into the dorms and was able to get him a place on my floor. So he was up there, but we were the only two Christians that I'm aware of that were on the floor. I'm sorry, actually, my roommate was also a Christian. So anyway, it was just the three of us there. But I started getting these phone calls late at night, about, I don't know, 2 or 3 months into the semester. And they would basically be about midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning. And it was some guy who would just yell and scream at me with all these vulgarities, you know, blank this, blank that, you blankety, blank, blank, blank. And he would refer to me specifically as a Christian. The guy clearly had an issue with me, clearly hated me, which puzzled me because I was well liked. I have no clue what it was all about. I never learned who the guy was. I assume he was maybe one of the guys on the floor or maybe one of the guys in the dorm. But for some reason, this guy did not like me, despised me, and he made it really clear. And I don't remember how many of these phone calls I would get, but they were coming maybe once every couple of weeks. And they went on for the whole year. Always the same guy. Always ranting and raving the same way, always making comments about my Christian faith and how much, you know, whatever. But again, I didn't do anything to deserve that I was aware of. I wish I could have met the guy. I wish I would have seen him face to face, not so that he could punch me, but maybe we could have had a conversation. Maybe we could have talked it out. I don't really know. But he never, I guess you'd say he's a bit of a coward. He never wanted to confront me face to face. But again, don't know what I did, but he just despised me for it. Now again, I didn't hide the fact that I was a Christian. In fact, I was really into certain styles of Christian music. And at the time, there wasn't a whole lot of Christian music available. I mean, it was things like Evie and I think Amy Grant and maybe Michael W. Smith. And
the Imperials.
What's that? The Imperials, yeah. Carmen, if you remember Carmen. You know, what's that? Yes, Mylon Lefevre, remember him too. But I was a little bit more into the edgier stuff. You know, I mean, when Stryper came out, the glam heavy metal guys with the long hair and the spandex, they were like tame compared to the stuff that I was drawn to. I actually did a radio show on the campus radio station, which was all Christian music, something that had never been done before. And on my floor, I had a pretty hefty sound system, and I would be one of those guys who would come home in the middle of the afternoon and jack up the sound. And I actually had guys on my floor that would come down and ask, well, who's this and who's that? And I was always trying to play new stuff. And so there were unsaved guys on the floor that would come down and borrow my Christian music. And I would sometimes hear it in their room, because it was actually good stuff. It was just hard to find, right? So I was pretty open about it, and apparently, being that open about it, some guy didn't like it and decided to make it known. So I was despised because of that. Well, today as we look into the story of Joseph, we're going to see something similar. I'm going to break the passage down today into just two sections. The first, just first four verses of chapter 37, we're going to see how Joseph's brothers hated him or despised him because he was faithful, trustworthy, and ultimately he had the favor of his father. And they despised him because of that. We're then going to see that their hatred and despising of him actually grew even more so when he revealed God's plan to them. So we're going to really look at a number of things about this. First is that he was despised simply because he was faithful, trustworthy, and favored by his father. But then secondly, because he made known God's plan. And because of that, they despised him even more. So let's look at the first part of this. Joseph was hated by his brothers because he was faithful, trustworthy, and favored by his father. The first four verses of chapter 37 starts like this. Now Jacob lived in the land where his father had sojourned, in the land of Canaan. These are the records of the generation of Jacob. Joseph, when 17 years of age, was pasturing the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought back a bad report about them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a very colored tunic. His brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, and so they hated him and could not speak to him on friendly terms. So the first thing we learn about Joseph here is that even as a young boy, he was faithful and trustworthy. Now you might say, well, where are you going to get that from this? Well, let me walk through this. Verse 2 tells us that Joseph was out pasturing the flocks of his father along with his brothers and his half-brothers. It stresses the fact that he was still young. He was only 17 years of age. And it adds further that he was still a youth. So it stresses the fact that he was young. He was much younger than his brothers. He was the second youngest of Jacob's 12 children. Only Benjamin was younger. But his oldest brother, Reuben, was 10 years older than he was. So again, it stresses the fact that he was a young'un. Now, verse 2 tells us that after shepherding alongside his brothers, he brought back, it says here, an evil or a bad report about his brothers. Some interpret this phrase, bad report, to mean that Joseph was a tattletale. You all know what that's like. We've all had brothers and sisters. We're not always equitable with one another. We tattle, right? Mom, Dad, you won't believe what so-and-so did. We call him a tattletale, a narc. So some interpret this here that Joseph was a narc. He was tattling on his brothers, trying to get them in trouble. Others interpret this phrase to mean that Joseph was disparaging or maligning his brothers, basically saying something untrue about them. He made up an evil report or a bad report to make them look bad, to puff himself up with pride or whatever it is. Others, however, and I fit into this camp, believe that what Joseph was doing was basically proving to be a faithful and trustworthy son. He was doing what a son should do. And the reason I say that is if you jump down into verses 12 through 14, read these with me for just a moment. Verses 12 through 14 of chapter 37 read like this. Then his brothers went to pasture their father's flocks in Shechem. Israel, that's Jacob, said to Joseph, are not your brothers pasturing the flock in Shechem? Come, and I will send you to them. And he said to him, I will go. Then he said to him, go now and see about the welfare of your brothers and the welfare of the flock, and bring word back to me. So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. What we find there is that at this particular instance, meaning a future one, Jacob's other sons were up in Shechem and they were taking care of the flocks. But Jacob was concerned about their welfare. of his sons and his flock. And so he then sends Joseph, go check on them and bring word back to me on the welfare of my flock and your brothers. As I look at what we see here in the beginning of chapter 37, I believe that that's exactly what was taking place here as well. That Joseph was out with his brothers, and there was something about the welfare of the flock or the welfare of his brothers that concerned him. It wasn't right. So he brought that back to Jacob and told Jacob exactly what the situation was. Now, the other reason I believe this is because what we learn about Joseph's brothers a little bit later here is they weren't the most responsible. In fact, their behavior is actually quite wicked in what they do. They attempt to kill him, and then they sell him into slavery. That just doesn't come up out of nowhere. Most of us are parents, right? Except for some of the young kids. As a dad, as a mom, you kind of get a pretty good feel for what your kids are like. Is it any wonder why Joseph might have been sent by Jacob to check up on the welfare of his flocks and his brothers? And so I believe that that's exactly what we have here. So I look at chapter 37 here, when it says that he brought back an evil or a bad report, that he was simply being a faithful son. He reported back to his father what he had seen. There was something that wasn't quite right, something that was of concern. And so in that respect, it's a bad report. It's not a favorable report. And so I believe that what we should see here is that he was being a faithful, trustworthy son, doing what he should have done. And it's unfortunate that it falls on one of the youngest boys. We find out a little bit later that Reuben, the oldest one, is the one that comes up with the plan, part of the plan, to try to maybe save him, but yet also then falls prey to what his other brothers want to do and sell him into slavery, and he's just as much a part of it. And it's not until later in Reuben's life where he kind of steps up and becomes a responsible son. So this all kind of falls on Joseph here. And I'll throw one last piece in here. Part of the reason I believe this about Joseph is because to see him as a tattletaler or as a narc doesn't fit the rest of Joseph's life, because almost everything that we see in the rest of Joseph's life is a godly, mature, gracious, faithful, trustworthy servant of God. And it would be out of character here that he came back tattling on his brothers or narking on his brothers. So putting all of that together, I believe that the proper understanding of this, that he brought back a bad report, means that he was being a faithful and trustworthy son, looking out for his father's flocks, making sure that they were taken care of. And when things didn't look like that, he brought back a report to his father that apparently his brothers weren't happy with. So contrary to the suggestion that Joseph was a little tattletale or sought to malign his brothers, I propose that these verses reveal he was being trustworthy and faithful, doing what he should have done for his father. So that's the first thing we learn about him here. The second thing we learn about Joseph here is that he was favored by his father. Look at verse 3 again. He was 17, he's out doing this, and he brings back his report. Jump down onto verse 3. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons because he was the son of his old age, and as a result, he made him a very colored tunic. So we learn that Joseph was loved by Jacob more than all of his other brothers. And it tells us it's because he was the son of his old age. It indicates that Jacob favored Joseph over his brothers because he had him when he was older. But there may have also been another reason as well. If you remember, Joseph was the firstborn son of who? Rachel, who he loved more than all of his other wives. Now some have said, well, why didn't he love Benjamin more than Joseph? Because Benjamin was the last one. He really would have been old, right? So if he loved Joseph because he was a son of his old age, why didn't he love Benjamin more? Nobody knows. We don't know. Some have suggested maybe it's because Rachel actually died when Benjamin was born. Maybe that was a hard memory for him. We don't know. But regardless, what we find here in the text is that Jacob actually favored Joseph. And we see that here as well because he made him a special robe. Now the text here says that it was a very colored tunic, very colored robe. We're not really sure exactly what that means. It could mean very colored, but it could have simply meant a long robe of some kind. The words used for garment are a bit obscure, so it's not really all that clear. It, again, could mean very colored, or it could mean simply a long robe that extended all the way down to his feet. I believe it was a very colored or a multicolored robe because there's a play about it. You know what I'm talking about, right? Joseph and the technicolored dream coat. Now, the part of the reason why I believe that the better translation is very colored is in part because the Septuagint translation translates it that way, and they were very close to that, much closer to the Hebrew text than we would be here. So they translated it that way. But I believe that archaeology actually suggests that it was a multicolored robe as well. What's really interesting is I love following sort of the archaeology related to the Exodus because, in fact, I was watching another documentary just not too long ago here now where basically you have a bunch of not only secular archaeologists but even some, quote, biblical archaeologists who are arguing that there is no evidence for the Exodus. There's no evidence that Israel, that the Hebrews ever were in Egypt. That's all just bunk. But here's the thing. The reason why that's typically the case is because of what we refer to as the Egyptian timeline. The Egyptian timeline sort of sets the timeline for almost anything related to ancient history. If you want to know when, you know, the Hyksos did this or that, or when other different ancient groups did this or that, they always compare it to the Egyptian timeline. But the problem is the Egyptian timeline is a mess. Nobody can agree on it. And it's because they don't always know if the pharaohs all served consecutive, if they're overlapping, or if this king or pharaoh reigned with this pharaoh, and it's just a mess. And anybody that tells you that the timeline of Egypt is consistent and solid, they're lying to you because that's not the truth. Now here's the thing. If you follow the traditional Egyptian timeline, you would look for evidence of the Israelites in Egypt at a certain time. The problem is, if the timeline is wrong, you're looking in the wrong time, right? And so David Roll and some other biblical archaeologists have said, well, let's just look at a different time period in the archaeological layers and other things. And when you look at a different time period, all of a sudden, you find all of this evidence of Israel in the Exodus. You just got to look in the right time period. Now, people reject that, saying, you can't do that, because we know the timetable. You can't do that. So here's the thing. Archaeologists, when looking at the correct time period, have actually found the region where the Israelites lived in Egypt. There's tons of Asiatic evidence in an area where they would have lived in the right time period. And in that particular area, they've actually found a complex where a ruler actually lived. And what they found was that, and this is actually back in the 1980s when they discovered this, they have this palace complex in a region where Israel would have lived, filled with Asiatics, which is what the Hebrews were, and it dates to the time of Joseph, if you properly look at the biblical timeline. In this particular complex, it's surrounded by two rows of 12 pillars. Interesting. In addition to that, the palace grounds have 12 tombs on them, one of which is a pyramid, which is reserved typically for rulers. In addition to that, when they're looking into these tombs, what they found inside the pyramid tomb was a statue, 6 to 9 feet tall, of an Asiatic, meaning Hebrew, Jew. They know the statue was Asiatic because it wasn't Egyptian in the way that it looked. The head was still partially intact, had an Asiatic hairstyle, Asiatic hair color, Asiatic facial features, and Asiatic skin tone. Stuff only common among the Hebrews, not the Egyptians. So again, what we have, when we look into the right time period, when Israel would have been there, the time period of Joseph, we find this palace complex right where the Hebrews would have lived. 12 pillars, two sets of 12 pillars, 12 tombs, one of them specifically for a ruler, and inside that tomb, where the ruler would have been, a statue of a Hebrew wearing a multicolored robe. Interesting. Now, does archaeological evidence prove that that was Joseph? Not necessarily. The other thing that's rather interesting is the only tomb that was found without bones was the pyramid tomb. Now, what do we know about Joseph? His bones were taken back to Israel. The other tomb still had the bones. Hadn't been robbed by tomb robbers. Now, it's possible that the pyramid tomb had simply been robbed by robbers. And it's just possible that maybe that particular ruler, whoever he was, just happened to look like a Hebrew, just happened to have a multicolored robe, just happened to have 11 brothers who were all buried around him. I guess that's all possible. It's all fascinating. You can actually, I've got DVDs that actually walk through it and everything else too. It's all rather fascinating. So again, I think the archaeological evidence would support that what Jacob did was he made a multicolored robe. I think the play is right. Made him a multicolored robe. And it appears that he may very well have either worn that robe or similar robes in Egypt when he became ultimately the second highest ruler in all of Egypt. It would make sense. Something his father had given to him. A way to remember his father. So, let's move on. The third and final thing we learn about Joseph, well, let me go back. His brothers hated him because of that. They hated him because he was favored by his father. And I'm sure every time they saw that robe, just got him enraged. The third and final thing we learn about Joseph in these first four verses is that all of this, possibly the report of his brother's bad behavior to Jacob, and certainly his favoritism, all of that led to them to hate him even more. Look at verse 4. His brothers saw their father's love, or saw his father loved him more than all his brothers, and so they hated him, and they couldn't even speak to him on friendly terms. That's hatred. That's despising somebody. When you can't even be kind or gracious. You know, it's one thing to just, I don't like being around him, but to literally never be able to say a kind word or to talk in a kind manner. So Joseph was hated by his brothers, one, because of the faithful, trustworthy nature that he had, reporting to his father, but also because he was favored by his father. So think about this for a moment. What does that mean for us? Is there anything we can draw from this? I think in many ways we're like Joseph. What do I mean by that? Joseph was a faithful and trustworthy son, had his father's favor, and as a result he was hated for it. I think that applies to us ever. As faithful and trustworthy Christians, we also have our Heavenly Father's favor. But Jesus said the world would hate us because of it. The reality is that when we live in obedience to Jesus Christ, when we are faithful and trustworthy servants, we're going to face a certain amount of reproach. The world's going to despise us for it. That's becoming more evident now than ever in American history, is it not? There was a time where being a pastor was considered to be the most trustworthy and honorable career. When I was in seminary back in the 90s, there was a list on one of my professor's doors of most reputable professions, and even at that time, pastor was down like number 46. I don't know where it ranks today. There was a time where, call yourself a Christian, people respected you for it. Now, that's not so much. You know, you're one of those bigots. You're one of those white, entitled, evangelical people. So when we live in obedience to Jesus Christ, when we're faithful and trustworthy, when we have God's favor resting upon us, the only thing we're guaranteed is that the world's going to despise us. Now, that doesn't mean that the world won't sometimes look upon us with favor. Sometimes you do the right thing, you know, and the Bible does indicate to us that keep our nose clean and do the right thing. Sometimes that'll gain us favor among the world, but it doesn't usually last very long. So we could find ourselves in Joseph here. I wish I had better news for you. But the world would love us, you know. His brother should have looked at him and gone, wow, he's really faithful and true. And wow, we should be more like him. You know, what older kid has ever done that with a younger kid? I want to be more like my younger brother. Just want to be like him. I feel so ashamed. I should be more like you. You're all laughing because you know. What child has ever looked at their parents' favorite child and went, good for you? Doesn't usually happen, does it? Come on, we all have favorites, don't we? You're all wondering now. Katie knows it's her. Kimberly does too. I'm obviously being goofy, but the reality of it is that there was no reason why Joseph should have been hated. He did the right thing. He was honorable. He was true. He did what his dad needed him to do. And yeah, we could argue that maybe Jacob didn't do the right thing by favoring Joseph the way he did. I think his brothers would have hated him anyway. So, let's move on. Second big picture thing. They not only hated Joseph because of his faithful and trustworthy nature and the fact that his father favored him, they also hated him because he revealed God's plan to him. Look at verses 5 through 11. We're going to start in verse 7 here in a second. But dreams are one of the ways that God revealed himself and his purpose and plans to Old Testament saints, even to some of the New Testament saints. We have an example of that here in Joseph because he had actually two dreams. And both of them, God revealed something to him. Very similar thing. But let's look at verses 5 through 7. Then Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. So it wasn't bad enough that they hated him because of who he was and because of his father's favor. But now, because he had a dream, it says they hated him even more. He said to them, please listen to this dream which I have had. For behold, we are binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf rose up and also stood erect, and behold, your sheaves gathered around and bowed down to my sheaf. Then his brother said to him, are you really going to reign over us? Or are you really going to rule over us? So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. So in the first dream, Joseph dreamt that he would someday reign over his family. Notice he didn't even have to interpret this dream for them. All he had to do was recite it to them. They knew exactly what the dream meant. Are you really going to reign over us? Are you really going to rule over us now? Probably a better way to reveal or to read this, the construct of their words actually implies a tremendous amount of disdain. I think a better way to read this would be, you don't really think that you are going to reign over us. That's very different. You think you're going to reign over us. They already hated him because of he was Jacob's favorite. But now the text says they hated him even more. And you notice, they clearly hated him for the content of his dream. His content revealed that he would rule or reign over them. So they certainly hated him for the content of the dream, but it also says that they hated him for his words, which I interpret to mean that they hated the fact that he even shared it with them. He should have just kept that kind of stuff to himself. The gall that you might share that with us. Now, some look at this, and some good commentators and pastors look at this and say, Joseph, you made a mistake. He was gloating. He shouldn't have done that. They had every right to hate him, and they portray Joseph here in bad light. He was just gloating. As you read that, do you see anything in that passage that suggests that he was gloating about it? No, he was sharing a dream. I would share a dream if God spoke to me in a vision. That's the whole point. They hated him, not just because of the content of the dream, but the fact that he was bold enough to share it with them. They hated him because he opened his mouth. You've probably heard the English idiom, "Don't shoot the messenger," or "Hey, I'm only the messenger." Well, Joseph's brothers didn't quite grasp that concept. They hated him because of not only the message, but they hated the messenger. Twice in these verses that we just read, it says they hated him even more because of what he had shared. Now, in the second dream, Joseph saw something very similar. Look at verses 9 through 12. Now, he had still another dream, and he related it to his brothers and said, "Lo, I have had still another dream, and behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars were bowing down to me." He related it to his father and to his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you have had? Shall I and your mother and your brothers actually come to bow ourselves down before the ground?" His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. So he has this second dream now. In this dream, he saw the sun, moon, and 11 stars all bowing down to him. The sun and moon obviously refer to his father and mother. The 11 stars obviously refer to his brothers. Once again, he didn't even have to interpret this. They knew the interpretation of the dream. In fact, they rebuked him. Well, specifically here, Jacob rebukes him. And once again, we could read this as, "You don't really think that we will bow down to you." Instead of saying his brothers hated him this time, it says they were actually jealous of him. What's there to be jealous of here? They're jealous because he got a dream and they didn't? Don't know. Doesn't really say why. It just says that they were jealous. They were envious of him. And because of that, they hated him even more. You notice that he's rebuked here by Jacob, which I find interesting. Jacob didn't like the idea. Now, again, this all violates familiar norms. And what I mean by that is, usually in the family, the oldest son was the authority figure, the responsible one. The others were supposed to bow down to him, if I can say it that way. This reversed it. This is a younger son saying, "Hey, I've had a dream. I've had two dreams. And guess what? You guys, I'm reigning and you guys are sort of bowing down to me." I can see why that offended them. Right? Even Jacob himself appears to have been offended because he rebukes him for it. But you notice what else it says about Jacob here? And this, I think, is a clue to us. It says his brothers were jealous, but his father kept the saying in mind. Why would Jacob rebuke him and then keep the saying in mind? It tells me that Jacob had a suspicion. There was something about this that Jacob was thinking, huh. He didn't like what he had heard. He rebuked him for it. But there was enough there to say, huh. I'm going to keep this in mind. Maybe because Jacob had seen the Lord too. The Lord had spoken to Jacob. Is it possible Jacob is saying, huh. Maybe these dreams really are the Lord speaking to Joseph. It's speculation on my part. But again, nothing in the scriptures is there by happenstance. And so the comment that Jacob kept it in mind tells us something. He didn't completely reject what he heard. He rebuked him for it, but he didn't completely reject it and walk away from it. So what we see here is that his brothers hated him, not just because of who he was and his father's favor, but they hated the fact that he had revealed to them something God had given to him in a dream. Now, whether they believed it was God speaking to him in a dream or not, doesn't really matter. They didn't like the content, they didn't like the message, and they didn't like the messenger. So what's our takeaway with this? I'm going to give us two. Clearly, one of the takeaways from this passage is that Joseph's dreams were a foreshadowing or a prophecy of how God would be using him to save his family. That's a good thing. those of us who know the rest of the story realize that Joseph became the second highest official in the land of Egypt. And because of his wisdom and his commitment to doing the right thing and to serving God and for serving the people there, interpreted the dreams of the Pharaoh to understand that 7 years of famine would be coming after 7 years of prosperity. And so we all know the story. Because of his work, he saves Egypt, saves many of the people outside of Egypt, and even saves his family. Everything in those dreams came true. So we know that that's what's happening here. So one of the takeaways for us here is to look at that and to realize that God is foreshadowing what he's going to do through Joseph. Something apparently his brothers never even considered. I'm not going to be too hard on them for that, because it's kind of a crazy thing to think, right? God spoke to you in a dream. You're going to rule over us someday? Huh, what's that about, kid brother? But we see it here. We know that that's exactly what God is doing. It doesn't have all the details, but it is a foreshadowing of how Joseph ultimately will serve as a type of Christ and save his father and his brothers. So that's the first thing we have to see here. And it'll sort of help us, because as we go through the next few chapters, what we're going to see is that things don't really go well for Joseph. Gets sold into slavery. Huh, how does that fit into your plan, God? You said someday I would rule, but now I'm a slave. Well, he starts to grow in those ranks under Potiphar, and then what happens? Potiphar's wife decides to try to seduce him, and Joseph does the right thing and ends up back in prison again. Lord, how does that fit into your plan? Remember the dreams you gave me? And then a baker and a cupbearer end up in prison, and Joseph interprets their dreams and sees God working there, and then says, finally, this is my out, because they'll go back and they'll tell the Pharaoh that I'm here and I'll get... No, that didn't really happen either, you know? And so we'll see how this dream... It would have been very easy for Joseph to become discouraged, knowing what God had said was supposed to happen, but it wasn't happening. And yet, what we see is that Joseph stays faithful. He never seems to lose his faith and trust in the Lord, in spite of that. And so we'll see how that plays out. The second takeaway here is that Joseph's own family rejected, even despised him for being faithful, for being true, but also simply for revealing God's message to them, God's plan to them. Again, they hated not just the message, but they hated the messenger. Let me ask you this, is the same true of us today? What happens when we reveal the truth, when we reveal God's purpose and plan to the world around us? Sometimes people accept it and rejoice. They get saved. More often than not, though, what happens? The world does not like to hear about God's purpose and plan, do they? But they don't just hate the message. They hate the messenger. Again, we're living in a time now where those who hold the convictions we do, those who take the name of Jesus, aren't always respected by the world around us. They're not always thought of highly by the world around us. In fact, we're considered closed-minded, we're considered judgmental, we're considered arrogant, prideful, you're all a bunch of know-it-alls, you just like to judge people. When we speak out on any number of issues, is that not true? When we say this is immoral or this is not right, we get judged for it. We get despised for it. We get hated for it. When we stand up, open the Word of God on a street corner and start to preach. Or when we stand up at a school board meeting and we say, this is just wrong to do this A, B, or C. When we mention the name of Christ, what happens? They don't applaud us, do they? Ridicule, mock. In fact, not too long ago, an administration put in place looking into the ministries, Christian ministries through the IRS to try to take away certain tax status and other things, all as part of an effort to shut down what we say and what we do. One of the things I'm struck by here, and this is, I think, key for us, did you notice after that first dream, when it became really apparent his brothers weren't happy, what happened with the second dream? Did Joseph shut his mouth? Did he say, I'm not going to do that again? I know what happened last time I opened my mouth. He didn't shrink back. Didn't appear to hesitate. Guys, I had a second dream. What does that tell us? When you open your mouth as a Christian, when you say things, maybe that your family doesn't appreciate, extended family, or your neighbors don't appreciate, or maybe you can tell that it makes people feel a little awkward around you. Does it make you want to shrink back? Does it make you want to keep your mouth shut? I've often thought about that with the job. One of the reasons I've enjoyed having a secular job, I could have gone into full-time ministry. I don't believe God wanted me to go into full-time ministry. I think God wanted me exactly where He's got me. One of the reasons I liked having a job was because I was not motivated. I didn't have a heart for evangelism. I wasn't driven to share the gospel with unsaved people. I could have just hung out with Christians all day long and counseled and ministered. But I knew, you know what, that's not good. And so I knew that by being in a situation where I'd be surrounded by unsaved people all the time, that I might get opportunity to share the gospel. And you know what, my heart for that has grown tremendously over the years. I've had plenty of opportunities with people that I work with that would never set foot inside a church. And God has used it. He's grown my heart and my love for these people. He's given me opportunities. He's made me realize how the importance of praying, that when I wake up in the morning, God, give me an opportunity this morning to talk to somebody at work, whether it's on the phone or in person. And He's given me those opportunities. I might not have done that had I been surrounded by Christians all day long. So for me, it's been a very good thing. But I'll tell you, there are times I'm like, boy, I could get in trouble if I offend one person. Might lose my job. And I've had others that have said, I can't speak up at work. I just can't. It's too dangerous. We have a policy at work, you know. No politics or religion. Joseph didn't shrink back from his brothers. Told him the dream anyway. Turn to 2 Timothy chapter 1, and we'll close with this. 2 Timothy chapter 1. Look down at verse 6. For this reason I remind you, he's talking to Timothy, to kindle afresh the gift of God which is in you through the laying out of my hands. I believe he's talking there about preaching the word. Partly because it comes out in the rest of the letter here. Timothy's gifting was in teaching and preaching the word of God. He says, for God has not given us a spirit of timidity, but of power and of love and of discipline. Therefore, do not be ashamed of the testimony of our Lord or of me, his prisoner, but join with me in suffering for the gospel according to the power of God, who has saved us and called us with a holy calling, not according to our works, but according to his own purpose and grace, which he has granted to us in Christ Jesus from all eternity. Notice what he says there. Don't be ashamed. Don't shrink back. Jump down to verse 12. verse 12. For this reason I also suffer these things, for I am not ashamed, for I know whom I have believed, and I am convinced that he is able to guard what I have entrusted to him until that day. Again, Paul says, I'm not ashamed. Jump down into chapter 2, verse 15. His charge to Timothy. Be diligent to present yourself approved to God as a workman who does not need to what? Be ashamed. Accurately handling the word of truth. So what does Paul encourage Timothy to do? Not be ashamed. Not to shrink back. Because remember, Timothy was facing opposition here in this church. There were false teachers here. There was regular confrontation, having to confront them on the false teaching. He probably wasn't going to be a very popular guy. Which is why Paul probably had to remind him 3 times, don't be ashamed, don't be ashamed. Accurately handle the word of truth. Again, I think about Joseph, and I think, boy, how much easier it might have been for him just to keep his mouth shut. I'm not going to share that dream. Boy, the first one got me into some trouble. I'm not going to do that again. But he didn't. And he was hated for it. Now, I wish I had better news for us. You know, all sunshine and roses. You know, now that you're a Christian, it's all just sweet and smooth sailing from here on out. Everybody's going to love you. You know, we were just down in Grand Cayman, and they identify themselves as a Christian nation. There are a lot of churches. There's 200 churches on this little tiny island. Some good, some not so good. But it's interesting because the gentleman that was taking care of us at the complex, he was basically took care of the grounds. Don't know that he was saved. He doesn't go to church, but he reads his Bible. He even mentioned he uses the YouTube app on his phone. He reads the Bible quite a bit, you know. And he asked us some questions. How do you feel about this? And how do you feel about that? And he talked about what was happening on the island and talked about some of the hypocrisy in the churches there. And he talked about he asked us a question about the LGBTQ stuff, you know, and a number of things. And you could even see in him that here on this Christian island, some of these ideals that we were founded with aren't so popular anymore. He didn't like what was happening to his island, you know? So that's the nature of it, folks. So I think this will be a good study for us because unlike Isaac, who struggled a little bit with his faith, unlike Jacob, who struggled a little bit with his faith, one of the things we're going to see about Joseph is right out of the gate, he appears to be this solid, godly young man who does what's right, who basically pays the price for it, but still continues to be faithful and true. I think he's going to be a good encouragement for us. And like I said this morning, I think it's encouragement to us not to shrink back. Regardless of the fact that the world may hate us because of our faithfulness to the Lord, our favor from the Lord, and declaring what the Lord has said to the world around us, we will be hated and despised, but just like Joseph, we can't shrink back. Amen?